I can't seem to say goodbye.
Welcome back to another episode of the Primalosophy Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Holderbaum, and this episode is brought to you by UFF, the Firefighter Wellness Program on a mission to make the best job in the world a healthier one. Go to nickholderbaum.com/UFF to get started.
Catherine Gildener is a best-selling author, novelist, and former psychologist. Her latest book, titled Good Morning Monster, Five Heroic Journeys to Recovery, is about patients she had in her psychology practice who, despite their desolate childhoods, have overcome their traumas and managed to thrive. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You said by the time you were 50, you had lost all empathy and you were burned out. Was writing this book your way of rekindling that inner flame?
Well, it is interesting that I left psychology when I was 50 because I decided to become a writer. Because I wanted to tell my own story. Like, I'd heard a million stories for over 25 years, and I decided, oh, I think I'll tell my own story. So I wrote three memoirs. But it is true. You do run out of empathy. I mean, you only have a certain amount of every emotion. And so I just thought, oh, I can't do this anymore. And when anybody would talk to me about my practice, I would be like, oh, I'm done with that. And then oddly enough, 20 years went by. And I know from 50 to 70, and I really missed my practice. I missed the patients. I missed the whole thing. I think I got a resurge of empathy, and the whole topic seemed terribly interesting to me again. So that's what, but it took me 20 years to refuel before I could write the book.
It was really brave of you to become a writer at age 50. Were you always brave, or did you learn to borrow your patients' courage throughout the years?
People have always said I was brave. They've said very bad things as well, but one of the good things is that they've always said that I was brave. So what I did was I said, when I left my practice, I said, if I get a publisher for my first book, I'll leave my practice. If I don't get a publisher, then I'm going to have to continue working, right? So when I got a publisher, I said, okay. I mean, I set up all these rules for myself to see if I could become an author at 50.
Can you give me an example of one of those rules?
Okay. One of them was you have to keep your full-time job, and then you have to get up very early in the morning and do your writing, because you know, I had this little fantasy that I could write at night. I can't. At 50, you can't write at night. You barely know your name. Hmm. So I got up at like 5 a.m. and worked until about 9. And then I went to work to my psychology practice. And then I said, okay, lots of people think they can be writers, but you have to be realistic. You know, you have children to go to college, et cetera. So you have to make sure that this is actually going to be a money-making proposition. And so when it was accepted by Penguin, I was very happy. My first memoir, although I didn't know at the time, you don't make any money writing anyway, but I didn't know that at the time.
Out of the hundreds of clients you've treated, why did these five heroic patients remain in your heart and psyche after 25 years?
You know, that's really an interesting question. What happened was I wanted to be scientific when I chose them. I wanted to go, so I got all of my past patients, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them together, because I've also worked in hospitals. So I got all of them together on 3x5 cards. And first of all, I wrote down the first five people that came into my mind, right? That's the first thing I did. Then I went through a huge 3-week thing of trying to sort out all the cards and decide, okay, I want an example of this. I want an example of that. I want ethnic. I want the, you know, there's all kinds of things that go into choosing these. And then in the end, I chose the five people that I thought of in the first 5 minutes.
Were there commonalities that you shared with all of the women in the book?
That is very weird that you're bringing that up. So now, of course, I have to confess. I didn't think there were that many, you know, commonalities. But they were all dogged in their own way, and I'm dogged. So, you know, there's a commonality. But the other thing was my editor said, Kathy, she had read my memoir, and I was raised by my father and his business. He was a pharmacist. So I was, he owned a drugstore, and I delivered medicine from the time I was 4 till I was 15. With a black delivery car driver. So what I do is my memoir is describing what my life was like with my father from age 4 on. So I mean, I didn't notice that each one of these women was raised by their father.
Do patients ever end up uncovering the psychologist's issues? Say, for example, if the psychologist isn't holding their patient accountable, It could be because they remind them of their own father or partner.
Totally. I talk about that in the book. And in the, I don't know if you remember in the Madeline case, what happened was her father was a very prominent philanthropist and builds hospital wings and everything. And he called me. He was once a patient of mine and said, "You have to see my daughter." And I said, "Oh, you know, no, I don't see families." You know, he said, "She's in New York. You've got to fly to New York every week. It's not a big deal." I said, "No, no, no." But he kept crossing my boundaries. You know, wherever I would go for coffee, he'd wind up at there and then say, "Listen, you've got to do this. You're the only person to do this, blah, blah, blah." So I did wind up going to New York and having her as a patient. And then I started thinking, why did I let this guy push me into this ridiculous situation? I'm the one with the boundaries. I can say no. I don't have an office anymore. I'm now a writer. So sometimes people have to get their own therapy. So I went and then one time I was at the coffee shop and the owner of the coffee shop said, "Hey, that guy that looks exactly like your dad was in." And I went, "Oh my God, like that is so Freudian and ridiculous." So I was like, "Oh, wow, that's something." So that was obviously a father thing where I didn't want to hurt his feelings. So I kept doing the things that he wanted me to do because I was the daughter and not the psychologist.
Is that one of the mistakes that you were referring to that you used to make early on?
No, oddly enough, I made this mistake in my last patient. I think I'd let my guard down. And I was seeing her in New York in her office and not in my own office. I think people, psychologists need to be, you know, in their own spot at their own desk. And, you know, you maintain your boundaries that way. But I didn't make that mistake in the beginning because I was hypervigilant about it. You know, I thought, oh, I must be very careful not to say anything about myself. I must be da da da. And then when I went back and just did this one case 20 years later, I think I let my guard down a bit. And that's not a good thing to do. You know, therapists shouldn't do that.
For firefighters, they can't let emotion get in the way of doing their job. Obviously, it would be really strange to see paramedics bursting into tears on the scene of emergencies, right? But right. We're all human. So when these thoughts and emotions would arise, how did you balance letting go of attachment with not letting go of the client-therapist bond?
Right. What I did was, and I think I learned this as a young child at the age of four, like when I would, you know, deliver medicine and, you know, the person would be dying of cancer and I'd say they can't take their medicine. Like they can't even open the bottle. So my father would say, "Open the bottle, get them a glass of water, but then you have to leave because we've got other deliveries to make." Right. So, you know, I think when a male runs your life, it is a, you know, as a young girl, you become less emotional and more intellectual. So it was like, no, I have a job to do. Right. So I think that's the type of person I became. So when people would say, you know, the horrible things that happened, like in the Alana case, you know, the terrible incest and cruelty and physical abuse, I just immediately did not focus on the emotional side, but on the intellectual side, like, how can I cure this? What will I do for each one of these steps? When she says this happened, how am I going to deal with that? And what examples will I use? And what will she do this week to try and deal with that? Like, I just went through it more intellectually, like just as a fireman wouldn't say, "Oh no, there's a burning baby." They would just say, "Okay, baby, got to get it out." I don't see myself as very empathetic. So when you have to choose your patients based on your own personality, you know, when people call me and say, "Hi, you know, my husband just died and I'm feeling sad and I want to talk to someone," I think I am not that person. I'm not that person. I'd rather take somebody very disturbed and has all kinds of symptoms and work on all of those symptoms. I'd rather have, like, you know, the project to work on. So I think you have to be careful who you choose. If you choose someone that just wants support, then that's, I see myself as not that person. But it's interesting. I was at a conference on trauma therapists. And oddly enough, a lot of very severe trauma patients have therapists very much like me. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Wow, why do you think this is?" And they said, "Because too much empathy really frightens traumatized people. They're not used to it."
I think that's the big difference between, I read a lot of Stoicism and they were big on sympathy over empathy. Like, you have to be able to know what it's like to walk in that person's shoes, but not letting that attachment get in the way of doing your job.
Absolutely. And also, if you're too empathetic and you say, oh, I know how you feel, et cetera, you lose any kind of ability to be an authority and to help them. You have to have an intellectual divide.
But you obviously have to be attached and bonded to your patients for these conversations to stick with you. So like all over time. So looking back, was there one conversation with the patient that was the most fulfilling for you?
I'm thinking. I had a number of them. I had a native indigenous client. You know, in Canada, we have huge indigenous population, and also these terrible things have happened with the residential schools and with abuse by the priests, etc. I don't know if you've read about it there, but it's headline news in Canada. And about 25 years ago, before we knew any of this, I had. I had a native who'd been through all that, and he'd been taught not to be an Indian. Like he called it Indian because this goes back 30 years. He said, you can't be an Indian because if you are, you get beaten by the nuns and priests. You can't use any language. You can't make any Indian signs. You can't have Indian hair. You have to be totally white. And as he said, they were very successful at getting you not to be an Indian, but they were unsuccessful in getting you to be white. Right. So I think one of the things he said to me was, you know what? I was walking down the street the other day and so he concentrated on not being an Indian. He didn't want to attach to anything indigenous. He didn't want to have anything to do with it. But of course he was bereft. He had no culture. He had nobody to talk to. And everybody that saw him thought he was a native. They didn't, you know, they didn't relate to him. And then when he would see natives, he'd think, I'm not one of them. Mm-hmm. So he was alone, you know, man without a country, man without an identity.
And man without a family as well?
Totally without a family, yeah. So, you know, he's a loner, right? So he was a long-distance truck driver. So one day he said he was walking down the streets of Toronto and he saw a native and he said, hi, man. And he said, and suddenly I felt like we were the same people. And that was very touching for me because we'd worked on that for years. Because, you know, in residential school, they work for years making you think that he had to confess every week in confession that he was a savage.
Wow.
You know, so they make you really humiliated about being native. And so it took a lot to get to turn that around. And I was so happy when he said that. That was a great moment for me.
Mm. These stories obviously have been sticking with me. I've been thinking a lot about Laura's heroic journey in the book, whose mother passed when she was six. She was abandoned by her father right when winter hit and left alone to watch her younger siblings in a cottage when she was eight. How did that feel to have your very first patient be someone with such a wildly dysfunctional childhood?
I know all of my, when I was a student, you know, you'd get students that would come in or people would come in and say, hi, I'm having trouble studying. Can you help me concentrate? And suddenly I get this person whose, you know, mother may have been the first patient, you know, right out of the barn, who exactly all the things that you said. I was completely, you know, taken aback. But that wasn't what bothered me so much is I think anybody who's done a PhD in psychology, what happens is you're there so long doing it all that, you know, you get good, you feel good because you've gotten an A or, you know, you've learned how to regurgitate the right amount of information in the right way, right? That's how you get ahead and get your PhD. But I had no idea how I would be as a therapist because there's a lot of people that are very good at school, but not good at therapy, right? They're different things. I mean, the ideal is you want to have both, but you know, you don't always have that. So I was really hoping when I saw her that, you know, she was difficult in every way. Like I would say, I want to take a history. And she goes, are you kidding? Oh, I'm from the family of idiots. Are you kidding? I'm not village of idiots. She called them. I'm not doing that. I'm not giving a history. Ugh, I'm here to talk about my problems, right? So she had like no psychological insight. Plus she was very rigid. And she said, and I don't want you ever, because one time she said something, well, that had to have been really hard for you. And she said, if you say stuff like that, everything's gonna fall apart. I won't be able to concentrate. And you have to swear that you'll never say anything like that again. Meaning this empathy, this tiny shred of empathy I put out was too much for her. So I thought, wow, this is not the cases that you see on the, you know, that you see when you're a student. It's not the cases you see. Sometimes you just have to say, okay, I've got to learn how to deal with this. Fortunately, with we had a lot in common. In the end, it worked out really well. But I mean, she was one of those people who was astonishingly stubborn. And of course, with stubbornness comes resilience, right? She's also hugely resilient. But no matter what happened to her, she fought her way through it. So then when I would suggest that her father, you know, when he left them in a cabin for, you know, 8 months in the freezing Canadian shield, she'd say, well, he knew I could handle it. I was eight already. That's old. My dad knew I could do that. So it took me years before she would see her father as someone who had abandoned her or who wasn't the greatest of fathers. Because she was so bonded to him, and he made her believe all the time that she was a great daughter, which is good of him, right? That she was a great daughter and that she did everything. And so all he wanted from her was for her to be an adult because he was a child. So, you know, when I took her actually to a classroom full of 8-year-olds so that she could, I said, this is the age you were when you spent all those months in that cabin taking care of your brother and sister. This is how old you were. And she looked at these tiny little 8-year-olds and she still didn't agree. She said, well, they're immature. I don't know where they found those. You know, so it took a long, long time. Sometimes when people are very, quote, stubborn, they're also very resilient. Like she would refuse to see the bad part of things. She would just say, I have to make this work. And she did. But showing any vulnerability when you're that type is hard.
Adulthood started at age 8 for her. Wow. Can you share the story of how Laura found hope and guidance by watching Colonel Potter on MASH how it helped her to see adversity as temporary?
Yes. No, I mean, it's really interesting because, well, first of all, you must be old because when I was talking to a high school class about this case, I mentioned Colonel Potter and no one had heard of MASH and no one had heard of Colonel Potter. So I'd lost my reference there, right? What happened was she was very resilient in the sense that she took the kids to school every day. Her 7-year-old sister and her 5-year-old brother, they got the bus, they got to school every day. And on Saturdays was when she would steal clothes for the week because she didn't know how to wash and dry them, right? She would steal clothes for the week. And then she would also steal food for the week, canned hams, canned stuff. And they managed to stay alive. But then psychologically, the two little ones began to fall apart. One became a bedwetter and the other one was crying all the time. So she just started thinking, oh my God, I'm giving them a bed. I'm giving them food. What else is there? I don't understand what's wrong with them. And then she had nowhere to turn. I mean, she was really facing the abyss because she knew if she turned them in, all of them in, they'd be separated and go to foster care. So she didn't want to do that. So one day they only got two shows, The World of Disney and MASH. And on MASH was Colonel Potter. And Colonel Potter used to talk to Radar. I don't know if you remember Radar. He was sort of a young, frightened, you know, very young guy who was sensitive. And Colonel Potter was a doctor. And Colonel Potter would say to him, don't worry, Radar, we'll be out of here soon. You know, this war will end. We will never have to look back on it. We'll be home with our families for Christmas. You've done a good job. You know, you've helped, you've done what you need to, et cetera. So whenever he would express emotional instability, which wasn't really instability, just a little fear, he would be there for him and say, don't worry, everybody has those feelings, right? So she thought, oh, I get it. You have to do that kind of thing, which she didn't know was emotional support. She had no idea what that was. So she immediately became Colonel Potter. So she would, like, when the kid wet the bed, she'd say, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It'll dry. You know, we'll steal some new sheets. Don't worry. Everything will be okay. And so the bedwetting stopped and so did the sisters crying. But it was like she learned it from Colonel Potter. And then she grew up to be very successful. And sometimes she'd be nervous giving a speech. And she told me that she would look out in the audience and there would be Colonel Potter. Like he would just be there for her. Sometimes he would just be silent. When she was in the hospital and she was very ill, she felt that, you know, she felt that Colonel Potter was there with her. So he became the good father.
What would Colonel Potter do? So she admired and even copied Colonel Potter's kindness and empathy, but then became terrified when you showed her empathy. Is that because she wasn't used to receiving it and she wanted you to play a certain role in the relationship?
It was perfect for her to have Colonel Potter on TV. He was separated from her and she could role play him. She could, she didn't have to feel what he was feeling. She could say, you know, okay, you know, I'm going to do exactly what Colonel Potter would do. And also she's somewhat of a great actress. She was a bit of a mimic and she would mimic Colonel Potter to me. And so she was able to say, okay, you know, he's giving empathy to Radar. But when I would give empathy in the same room to her, it was too much. It was way too much for her to handle. Because she would, what would happen as we found out as the years went by, real feelings would come up within her whenever you would say that had to have been hard. And she could not take those feelings. And she felt if I express any feelings, I will fall apart and I won't be able to control my world.
When I hear these stories like Laura's or Danny's, I find myself comparing my childhood and my suffering to theirs and think, what I've been through is less significant. Do you see this kind of comparison a lot? And is this hierarchy of suffering ever productive or helpful?
No, not in a word, no. What is interesting, like look at someone like Laura. She was completely deprived. Father might have killed the mother. He might have killed the second mother. I mean, both of those are up in the air, right? They never, because, you know, in real life, the police just come and see someone dead and take them away. They don't suspect anybody did anything. And then for the second wife, when she died by falling down the stairs, they never did anything other than say, well, she was a bit of a drunk. So we'll just, you know, no one investigated anything. Right. So, I mean, she was from that kind of a family, right? Who a father who could say, I'm going for cigarettes and not come back for 3.5 years. Right. So, I mean, that's, but she had, in a way, a lot of self-esteem. She had ideas about what she wanted to do with work. She would start new committees. She started a whole foundation. And she said, you know, I know you don't like my father. I know you think he's terrible. She said, but I want you to know one thing. My father never, ever said a mean word to me. My father, whenever I would go to a bar and find him there, I'd take his check and take it home and say to the bartender, throw out his drink. The next morning, he always said, thank you. What would I do without you? Mm. So, yeah. So, I mean, it looks like she had a terrible life, but in fact, it's a lot worse to have one of those, you know, highly educated mother and fathers who say, you know, didn't you do your homework? Didn't you do your homework? Why aren't you getting an A? This kid got an A. Why can't you study? What do you do? You know, blah, 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 blah. She was basically not taken care of, but she was never, ever belittled. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, sometimes people, like I can see people that, you know, kids go to private school and yet they're, you know, vomiting every morning from anxiety because they're not meeting their parents' needs. You know, and I mean, you know, her parents' needs were just, he just wanted to be taken care of.
Did you ever find yourself thinking this way, though, that maybe someone else has been through so much worse that your suffering isn't valid?
I see what you mean. That's what you were asking before. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, all suffering is valid. All suffering is valid. I mean, I would see clients and it seemed to me hardly anything had happened to them. A little bit, like maybe my father was in a car accident, but he's okay now, but I can't calm down and my heart pounds 24 hours a day. So you say, well, like, that's not huge, but whatever happened to him, whatever that father meant to him, whatever the terror of abandonment was, this is how his body's responding to it, right? And I mean, everybody suffers in a different way. I mean, that's like Christ on the cross said, I'm forgiving all of your sufferings, not just those that have had a hard time.
Yeah, I guess it's one thing to think I haven't been through what they've been through. And it's another thing to think I can channel some of my patients' strength from their stories of overcoming adversity kind of as fuel to get through challenging times.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and then when you look at the Native patient, Danny, in the book, he was never really lonely. Because the only time he was lonely was when he was 5 years old and put in residential school and he not allowed to talk ever. And he didn't get enough to eat, lost 3/4 of his body weight the first year. So, I mean, he learned right away, I must shut up. I must make no friends. I must make no eye contact and I'll get out of this alive. So, I mean, that was his suffering. But his first year was total suffering. Like, you know, I want my mom and my dad. I'm 5 years old. He came from a happy family that was eventually destroyed. But, you know, so then he finally learned you've got to turn off your suffering. But what happens when you turn off your suffering is you can't. You can't, because then you turn off all your emotions. You can't, if there's no switch just for suffering, it's either all your emotions are blocked or they're on. So he wasn't allowed to have any joy. So I said, you know what? If you keep going like this, you'll never have any joy. And he laughed and said, joy? Like, he thought that was hilarious. Like, you know, it's better not to feel, because believe me, there's not much joy, right? I mean, that had to be our therapy of where he learned that he had rights to be a human being. He had rights to make eye contact. He had rights to talk to people that upset him and tell them that, you know, and that was like actually learning from age 5 on how to behave.
It's like learning that we determine our own lives according to the meaning we give to our past experiences.
Right.
Is it possible to explore and examine our childhood attachments and coping mechanisms on our own, or do we need to have a trained professional help us unpack them?
You know, I've always been a believer that a trained professional helps you, because Freud is right about one thing, and that is that there are defenses. And we build walls, because we'll say, I can't look at that. That's terrifying. But then we act on it. We'll act on it and act on it, but we won't know what we're acting on. It's over here locked away. Mm. Right. So if you have somebody who says, hey, you're being very defensive about that. There's something terribly upsetting about that. Let's go into your child. What happened, you know, that caused all this, you know? So go into each channel of the defenses and knock each defense out. Right. Yeah. Now, if you know, therapy is expensive and it's time consuming, and they now have CBT, CBT is where you have a notebook, and you know, you write down each thing that you did right and each thing that you did wrong, each of your emotions each day. And throughout writing that notebook, you will find your own patterns. You know, so I mean, I think those notebooks are really a good thing to work through. And then if you still have your same problems, then make an appointment for a therapist. Or if you drink too much, you know, go to AA. You know, it's better than therapy for you. It's all organized for an alcoholic. If you have from a dysfunctional family, go to Adult Children of Dysfunctional Families. They have a group. You know, I'm thinking, because you know, you're in America where therapy costs money, right? Whereas in Canada, we have a healthcare plan. But I'm just saying, you know, there's a lot out there that you can do before you hit therapy.
And I want to talk more about Freud here in a second. But first, if someone wants to start seeing a therapist or a psychologist, how can one become more psychologically oriented before doing so?
Well, I think you can read one of those CBT workbooks. I mean, it doesn't help to read Freud. It's too theoretical, right? I mean, you know, he's got 23 volumes. You know, you can't start there unless you know, want to really invest, you know, years in studying him. I think what those notebooks are great. I mean, there's all kinds of self-help things that are quite good. Like if you're an incest survivor, they have incest survivor groups, they have incest survivor workbooks. They have, you know, for each thing, there's all kinds of stuff that you can read. And it helps you, because by the time you get to the therapist, you're like, I realize this is a huge thing. This thing happened to me. You know, so, I mean, usually you'll figure out some stuff and block others. But you know, it's helpful. But usually people buy those CBT books and never open them. They always show up at my office with them still wrapped in plastic because they're frightened, right?
Have you read the book, The Courage to Be Disliked?
Oh, no, I should. I have that kind of courage. I'm disliked by so many.
It's right. An incredible book that I recommend to everybody. It's about Alfred Adler's theories. And
no, Alfred Adler very well. Because, you know, he worked with Freud, and his whole thing is siblings. He started out saying sibling relationship is hugely important. And Freud said, no, I don't think so. And he said, yeah, he was trying to put the modern part into Freud.
Yeah. In it, they argue that Freud's ideology and the trauma argument is determinism, and also the road to nihilism, that it denies our free will and treats humans like machines. So they argue instead that people are not driven by past causes, but they move toward goals that they themselves set. Do you think Adler was onto something when he said we don't suffer from our so-called trauma, but instead we make out of it whatever suits our purposes and goals?
Yes, I think he is onto something, and he was quite interesting for for his time. I mean, he was there in 1895, right? I mean, he was seeing a lot of modern connections, you know, because he was seeing patients as well. And not all of them were fitting into this Freudian model. But I think sometimes people make small traumas huge because they're terrified of life. You know, their life is very frightening for them. They feel inadequate. They feel, you know, that by the time they're 6 years old, they're feeling like they can't function in the world. You know, so then, that trauma, something becomes what they hide behind, you know. And then some people that have horrendous trauma plug along and just say, I've got to find a way out of this. And I think that's a lot of it, is personality style.
I think it's just really empowering to believe that no matter what has occurred in your life up to this point, it has no bearing at all on how you live from now on.
I think it has no bearing as long as you deal with it. As long as you, because otherwise I think that you can become anxious or you can become very defensive and not know why. Like, it's like, why every day do I have to walk around the block 6 times? I think it's a fresh air, but I really hate it. I don't know why I'm doing it. And then, you know, like, you need to understand why you're doing things. But if people understand why and they work hard on it, and it's hard work, I think they can be okay. It's amazing what, I mean, we'll look at the 5 people in the book, what they've lived through, and they're basically okay.
Now, I've failed plenty of times when coaching firefighters and trying to uncover their intrinsic motivations. Were there times when you failed to uncover the source of one's pain, or times where you realized there was nothing to be uncovered?
Yes. I mean, with some people, you're just not going to click. I found that too. And I don't know, there's kind of a magic elixir there between people that where you relate or you don't relate. And I always say to people, go to a therapist for 3 sessions. If you don't like him or her at the end of the 3rd session, or you don't feel trusting in some way, find somebody else. Because, you know, not everybody is meant to be with everyone else. And sometimes people are not introspective. That's their style, is they're not introspective. It's hard if you're not introspective to be in therapy when you're asked to, you know, recall things, and you really have to bring up all kinds of unconscious things with which many people don't even remember, or that's not their style of operation.
Yeah. I tell firefighters they need to start therapy before they need to start therapy.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's a great line. That's a great line.
And Kathy, I wanted to ask about the tools you use in your sessions. And one that stuck with me was silence. Why is therapeutic silence so therapeutic? And is this a practice that we can all use in our daily lives?
You know, I learned a lot of silence from Danny, the native patient in the book. In fact, he didn't speak for 2.5 months. Like, that's extreme, right? Mm-hmm. It's really hard for me to be silent, but I learned a lot about it in therapy, because sometimes you'd say, well, I'd say, do you feel this way? They'd say, no, I don't feel that way at all. You know, I'm not upset about my mother's death. I mean, you know, she was old and people die, and I'm not upset about it. So then if you just sit silently for a while, then suddenly they'll start to cry, or they'll say, actually, I'm brokenhearted. Conversation is a defense. It's a chatter. Right? You know, how do you feel about this? How do you feel about this? But if in fact people say something and then you back up and let them live with those feelings for even a few minutes, usually the real stuff comes out. I mean, it's hard to do at a cocktail party. People think you're crazy, right?
Yeah. We all have constant stimulus now. It's almost like we have silence deficiencies.
Yes. Everything blocking you from your real feelings.
And another tool I wanted to talk about, which is probably the most important tool of all, is just presence. Can you talk about what it means to offer your true presence to your patients?
Yes. In a way, here's a mistake that turned into an issue of presence with Alana. Alana had had a terrible, terrible life. Her father was a sadist. In fact, he was the vice president of the Ted Bundy fan club. That tells you a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he did terrible things to her as well. And, you know, there was a gun in the house, and sometimes he would make her stand and he would shoot all around her, you know, sort of like William Tell. Yeah, he would do that, right? And when the police finally did come, they saw all of these bullet marks. And I said, did you ever, I was so angry at him. I said, did you ever have the feeling of just picking up that gun, turning around and shooting him? Did you ever have that feeling? Hmm. She said, yeah, but I mean, you know, I would go, I'm the one that would go to jail, not him, right? You know, like she said, I would then be put, you know, in a foster home and it would be worse, right? So she thought things could be worse. She didn't know that, in fact, they really couldn't. But much later in the therapy, she said that, and I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have said, did you ever feel like killing him? I mean, that's not helpful for a therapist to say, right? It's not constructive. Mm-hmm. But I was so, she said later, I really realized you were on my side, that you were really present for this, because the rage on your face and the idea of like, this man is despicable. And what, you know, how did you save yourself from not killing him? She said, I realized at that moment that you were utterly, utterly on my side and believing in me. So I think you can let people know, you know, I think people are, anybody in therapy, they're pretty good at, any person is pretty good at reading your feelings.
You were so in the moment, but you just have to be careful not to get lost in that moment.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it wasn't a wise thing to say, but you know, I mean, that was my first thought was, how could you endure this day after day? You're alone in the forest, pick up a gun and shoot him. Right. You know, that's what I felt a few times. Right. But I mean, that's not helpful, but she knew that it, when she said that, she said, you don't know how many times I wanted to kill him. How many, many times. And then she became a computer or what is it? Game expert on those games that you play on computer where you shoot people. And she rose to the top of their, of the ladder of people. And she said, what I did every day was I thought about when I would kill these guys on, I would think I was killing him. Wow. She said, I became really good at it and really focused.
And talk to me about the process of following up with each of them decades later. What kind of condition were you hoping to find them in? And what questions did you have for them?
That was very interesting because, you know, a psychologist never sees their patients 30 years later, right? I think the questions, the answers that surprised me most was, if you look at Peter, he is the Chinese musician. His mother locked him away in a room and didn't let him out until he was five and just dumped food in. So when he went to kindergarten, he didn't have any language, not English, not Chinese, right? He wasn't able to communicate at all. They thought he was slow and put him in, he got into the slow classes, et cetera, from there. None of that was true. He isn't any of those things. But one day someone threw, his mother was given a tiny piano because somebody left it in the restaurant that she worked, that she owned. So she took the piano up and left it in his room. And it's all he had for the first 5 years was this piano. That was it. And a red tomato can for urinating. Those are the two things that he had. And so he began playing the piano, and then he thought the piano was talking to him. He thought the piano was like a mom. Like when he felt sad, he could make the piano sad. And when he was happy, he could make the piano happy. And then he played all of the keys and he would hold it next to his heart. And it would sort of reverberate, kind of like a mom's heart. Anyway, he became, as an adult, not surprisingly, one of the best jazz players in Canada. And Drumbeat magazine said, I've got to remember the exact quote. Every emotion he expresses is completely heartfelt, as though he's speaking to you. So I thought, so that was like it was his mother. So it was an interesting exercise. But then when I saw him 30 years later, I said, if you had one thing to change in your life, what would it be? And he said, I wouldn't change a thing. And I said, but your mother beat you. She beat you. She was unkind to you. You know, you got in the slow stream. He got out of that. He's actually a bright guy. But, you know, he failed kindergarten because he didn't know how to hold hands. He didn't know what stand in a circle meant. He didn't know what play with others meant. You know, he had no idea. He wasn't toilet trained, nothing. Right. So, I said, wouldn't you want all those things to change? And he said, you know, not really. He said, because my keyboard is my thing. My keyboard is what I love more than anything. And I've been really good at it and it's been good to me and I've been successful. He said, and if I hadn't been alone with it, I would have been like every other little kid and maybe taken a lesson once a week. This way I learned it from the ground up and it was my only companion and I would never be the same musician that I am today.
And Laura said the same thing. If she could live her life over, she probably wouldn't have wanted it to be any different. Is this because their childhoods made them the adults they are today and they're proud of that?
Well, I think that's what Laura, thought that, you know, she said, you know, we've talked about this before where her father looks really bad on paper, but in fact, he never criticized her. Like every day when she worked with him at the chip truck, you know, where they sold chips from the truck, he would say, "You are my right-hand man. What would I do without you?" So, I mean, she always felt that whatever job she did, he was pleased with, right? So she said, "You have no idea how important that is." You know, and she said, "And all you did was look at his bad side, right? Like, you know, like that he was a murderer and that he went to jail and, you know, all of these other things." She's saying that's one side of him, right? You know, but I mean, I was floored that both of them said, you know, yeah, I would take it just exactly as it was.
Okay, Kathy, two questions that I ask everybody at the end of my podcast. Okay. If you'd be so kind to share what's on your shelf, are you reading anything good right now?
I'm now reading Five Little Indians. It's by a woman named Goodman, and it's about natives. It's about native people and what happens to them following the lives of five people and what happens to them after a residential school and what are their scars and how they keep in touch with each other, et cetera. Yeah, so I'm reading that right now.
Thank you for sharing that. I'll add it to my list. And then last question, if you could have a drink with anyone in history, who would you choose and why?
Well, I think I would choose Freud. I did a PhD on Freud and Darwin's influence on Freud. And so, I mean, Darwin is very clear about, I'd like to meet Darwin too, but he's very clear about his theory, very, very clear. But I'd love to have a drink with Freud now. I've actually thought about this before because I would like to talk to him about modern medication. He wrote this, that depression was caused by this, that, and the other thing. And you know, he didn't know anything about, it was 1895. He didn't know anything about medication or depression or what really causes it. You know, he tried to bring up incest. He tried to say how much incest there were. And everyone said, "Stop that. You will kick you out of the profession if you mention that ever again." So he didn't. Yeah. So I'd like to catch up with him and say, "What do you think about all these things that have happened?"
Well, Kathy, this was a really great conversation. It was so nice talking with you. I'll have links to your book in the show notes. Where else do you want people to go if they want to connect with you?
My website, www.gildener.com.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to follow me on social media at Primalosophy. And if you want to subscribe to my weekly newsletter, Sunday Goods, you can find the link in the show notes. Shakoba.